This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 15, 2005, from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. The insurgent National Liberation Army in Colombia removes landmines at the request of a community. The House is ready to pass Bush's $81 billion wartime request and the Real ID Act along with it. And a San Francisco court says that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry in California. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Pauline Bartolone with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A UN fact-finding team has finished its investigation into the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The team will report its findings to UN Secretary Kofi Annan today and is expected to charge a devastating cover-up at the highest levels of Syrian and Lebanese intelligence. Both Syrian and Lebanese officials deny any role in the assassination. Meanwhile, Syrian intelligence officials are packing up and leaving the Lebanese capital today after a million people showed opposition to Syria's presence at a demonstration yesterday in Beirut. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrives in India today, beginning her six-nation tour of Asia. Binu Alex has the story.
The visit of U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to South Asia is the first diplomatic visit since President George W. Bush returned to power. Starting in India today, the week-long trip includes Pakistan, Afghanistan, Japan, South Korea, and China, respectively. Top on the agenda in her meeting with Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh tomorrow is the creation of a cordial Indo-US relationship. They will discuss high-tech US exports, a strategic partnership framework, and joint exercises by armed forces of the two countries. Rice will also focus on India and Pakistan relations, aimed at changing the hostile atmosphere to a friendlier one by facilitating dialogue between the two nations. From Ahmedabad in India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
The Congressional Ethics Coalition held a press conference today calling for more accountability in the House of Representatives Ethics Committee. Shirley Chang reports from D.C.
The coalition was urging support for House Resolution 131, introduced by Ranking Democrat Alan Mulahan. This resolution would repeal and modify some of the ethics rules changes passed by the House at the beginning of the 109th Congress. Those rules changes have significantly weakened the ethics process in the House, such that the committee is now unable to act on the piles of ethics matters now pending before it, and the panel cannot conduct its most basic functions, including providing day-to-day advice to members about ethics issues. Melanie Sloan, Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, attributes the weakening of the Ethics Committee to House Majority Leader Tom DeLay.
What happened at the Ethics Committee at the beginning of the year was like a well-orchestrated mob hit. Anyone who had anything to do with Mr. DeLay receiving an unprecedented 3 admonishments last year was taken out. Of course, this was organized by none other than the mobster-in-chief in our government, Tom DeLay himself.
Democracy 21 President Fred Wertheimer says Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert needs to schedule the Mulahan resolution for an immediate vote. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Shirley Chang.
1 week after Kosovo's Prime Minister Ramush Haradinaj resigned and surrendered to The Hague to face war crimes charges, Kosovo's President Ibrahim Rugova survived a bomb blast which tore through his motorcade early this morning. President Rugova was unharmed, but the bomb injured one passerby. At the time of the blast, Rugova was on his way to a meeting with UN Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana to discuss the creation of a new government in Kosovo. No one has been officially charged with the bombing. The British government has quietly abandoned its controversial plans to introduce biometric ID cards. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The ID card scheme proposed by the government went much further than existing ID cards in other European Union countries. They had planned a national database of fingerprints, facial scans, and iris scans. The idea for the scheme was put forward after 9/11 as an anti-terrorism measure, costing at least £3 billion. But those opposed to it say Spain's ID card system failed to prevent the Madrid train bombings. Parliamentary backing for ID cards diminished after the High Court ruled late last year that some British anti-terrorism legislation enacted after 9/11 was unlawful. Since then, Parliament has seen some of the longest and most bitter debates in its history over alternative anti-terrorism proposals. The government is expected to reintroduce the idea to Parliament in the future. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Pauline Bartolone for Free Speech Radio News.
The House of Representatives is poised to pass President Bush's $81 billion request for Iraq and Afghanistan. Most of the request is earmarked toward buying weaponry, ammunition, and body armor for soldiers in Iraq. And, as Mitch Jeserich reports in a last-minute deal, the House attached the controversial immigration measure known as the Real ID Act to the wartime supplemental request, an act which critics say was meant to force the anti-immigration bill into law.
Without the support from the Democratic leadership, a small number of House Democratic representatives say they will oppose the $81.3 billion war supplemental request to fund further military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Representative Lynn Woolsey of California.
If Secretary Rumsfeld and the Pentagon couldn't manage to get body armor to our troops with the first $100 billion we gave them, why would we trust that they will do even more with our hard-earned American tax dollars?
The House is expected to pass the supplemental request sometime later this evening or tomorrow. The Senate will take it up in April. The measure will spend about $75 billion on military activities. Less than $2 billion will be spent on reconstruction in Afghanistan, and another $600 million will go to build a so-called super embassy in Baghdad. Amongst numerous reports of fraud and abuse of U.S. contracts in Iraq, Democratic Representative Barbara Lee, also of California, says Congress is on the verge of giving President Bush another blank check.
Given the documented cases of waste and fraud perpetrated by contractors like Halliburton, requiring accountability on these funds is only the responsible thing to do. It's really the height of hypocrisy for members of Congress to say they support our troops and fail to insist on accountability on how our funds are being spent to support our troops.
Are we catching all the waste? No chance. No chance. But I can't imagine how much congressional oversight it would take to catch the waste.
Republican Representative John Klein represents Minnesota.
We have an obligation to provide congressional oversight. We have many, many hearings. I sometimes worry that the leadership in the Pentagon is spending more time over here, you know, preparing for hearings and answering our questions than they are doing their everyday job. And I say that somewhat facetiously, but still, you can carry oversight too far. It needs to be focused.
On late Monday night, the GOP leadership in the House attached the controversial anti-immigration bill called the Real ID Act to the supplemental war request. The measure would disallow undocumented immigrants from receiving standard driver's licenses, make it harder for immigrants to receive asylum, complete construction of a wall between San Diego and Mexican border, and allow bounty hunters to track down undocumented immigrants who disobey deportation orders. Again, Republican Representative Klein.
So an agreement was reached last year that we would take this up on the first, quote, must-pass piece of legislation of the 109th Congress, and that's what we're doing here.
Some of the critics have said that because it's a controversial measure, mm-hmm. that it's being attached to a must-pass bill, so to force it through, mm-hmm. instead of going through a regular democratic process, as the bill is already passed in the House about a month ago or so.
Right. I'm sure the critics would say something like that, but this is a democratic process. This is well within the rules of the House.
They'll do anything to blackmail members of Congress to vote against their own best interests or the interests of their communities.
Democrats like Lynn Woolsey see adding the Real ID Act to the supplemental request as a move to strong-arm the measure into law. Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News.
A San Francisco court handed a victory to the gay rights movement yesterday, saying same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry in California. Superior Court Judge Richard Kramer struck down the state's voter-approved ban on same-sex marriages. The ruling follows San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom's decision last year to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. The California Supreme Court ruled that he had exceeded his authority, but asked a lower court to consider broader issues. Kramer said in his new ruling, quote, "It appears that no rational purpose exists for limiting marriage in this state to opposite-sex partners," unquote. Christopher Martinez reports.
The San Francisco court ruling is the latest in a series of victories for supporters of same-sex marriage. About 4,000 same-sex couples got married in San Francisco last year after Mayor Gavin Newsom ordered city officials to issue marriage licenses to lesbian and gay couples in defiance of state law. The California Supreme Court halted the marriages, but it invited lawsuits to challenge the decision. The city of San Francisco and a dozen same-sex couples did sue, and they won in a decision by a San Francisco trial court. Lancy Wu was one of the plaintiffs. Wu and her partner Christy Chung stood in line for 9 hours to get a marriage license after Valentine's Day, but they couldn't get in.
It's interesting. It's for something that doesn't hurt anybody else. I would think a lot more people would be pro for it, just because it's all about just us caring, you know, me caring for my own family.
The San Francisco trial court ruled that California's marriage code, limiting marriage to a man and a woman, is unconstitutional because it's gender discrimination and violates a fundamental right to marriage. San Francisco Superior Court Judge Richard Kramer wrote in his decision that, in his words, the state's denial of equal protection cannot be justified simply because such constitutional violation has become traditional. Kate Kendall is the director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, one of the groups that represented the plaintiffs.
It is fast approaching the day where it is no longer tenable. It is no longer part of civilized society for the government to discriminate in marriage against couples based on sexual orientation.
Other courts have ruled in favor of same-sex marriage in Washington State and New York City. But opponents of gay marriage vow to continue the fight. Glenn Levy is an attorney with the Alliance Defense Fund's Marriage Litigation Center.
Actually, this decision probably adds fuel to the movement towards a federal marriage amendment.
The Alliance Defense Fund describes itself as fighting for religious freedom, the sanctity of human life, and traditional family values. Levy argued the case for the defendants, and he says the Alliance Defense Fund will appeal the ruling.
The state Supreme Court will make the final decision in this litigation. If the court sustains Judge Kramer, however, I suspect that the people of California would make the ultimate decision.
San Francisco Assemblyman Mark Leno performed some of the marriages that were later overturned by the California Supreme Court. He called the new ruling a great victory for love, commitment, and family.
Even our adversaries know there is nothing presently in any constitution that says we have the right to treat certain people, because of whom they love, as second-class citizens.
Leno has a bill in the Assembly that would change the marriage code to define marriage as being between two people instead of a man and a woman. Meanwhile, parties in the lawsuit will be preparing for the certain appeals, and thousands of others, like Lancy Wu, will be waiting to see if they can get married.
You know, I'm holding my breath because it's so hard to be excited and then feel like it could get taken away again.
Reporting from Berkeley for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The U.S. public has until March 17 to comment on a plan that would allow oil and gas drilling in the wildlife area of Wyoming's Great Divide. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the Senate is set to vote on a controversial plan to allow exploration and drilling in parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Selena Musuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op reports.
Inferi is the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska.
Yeah.
It was set aside by the Navy,
but it's a road.
For its oil development.
It's a permanent road.
What does that have to do with ANWR?
Anti-drilling conservationists and a representative of the Department of Interior argue after a pro-drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge press conference sponsored by Republican Senators Ted Stevens and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Senator Stevens fought 24 years to further tap into Alaska's oil reserves because he says that drilling in the refuge would decrease the United States' dependency on foreign oil. To bypass a string of filibusters, Stevens attached the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, provision to the budget resolution bill.
That's the difference between this Senate and the Senate back in the 70s when we considered the oil pipeline. They knew security. Not one of them. I challenge you. I went back and read it again. I challenge you to find one single word about filibuster at that time.
Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington disagrees with Stevens. Cantwell introduced an amendment that could kill Stevens's provision.
I think these guys have realized that the president's energy policy has not sold to Democrats and Republicans for the last two sessions. And so I think that they are now, instead of changing their energy policy to something that's acceptable to members, trying to find out new ways or new tools to change the process.
Lisa Beach is the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. The Gwich'in people live just outside of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, also known as the sacred place in which life begins, and are dependent on the porcupine, caribou herd, and fish that live in the refuge. Unlike the Inupiat, many of the Gwich'in are against the drilling of the ANWR and consider it a human rights issue, says Beach.
What we see now is simply environmental racism. Our people are expendable if development is being allowed. And what it is doing is repeating history. For example, what happened to the Plains Indians and the buffalo.
Selena Masuda, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
The Environmental Protection Agency announced its new mercury regulations for the nation's power plants today. The new rules are expected to reduce mercury emissions by nearly 50% by 2020. But critics of the new rules say that's not soon enough to curb the dangerous effects of the toxic element. As Leslie Clark reports, in states like New Mexico, there's concerns that too many people will be harmed before mercury emissions are curtailed.
Mercury pollution is a known cause of nerve damage in fetuses and young children. In New Mexico alone, it's estimated that as many as 20,000 women of childbearing age have elevated levels of mercury. That's according to New Mexico Health Department's Chief Medical Officer, Ron Voorhees. For that reason and more, Dr. Voorhees says power plants should be regulated on an international, national, and state level.
Every individual plant around the world could argue that they're not really the problem, and it's everybody else that's the problem. And if you don't start someplace, then nothing gets done. And so we think it should be regulated nationally. If the EPA was doing a good job, if we felt that their proposals were adequate, we wouldn't care as much about state regulation, but we do not feel that they're adequately protective of public health.
Public Service Company of New Mexico, or PNM, owns one of New Mexico's coal-fired power plants. Company chairman and CEO Jeff Sturba agrees mercury pollution is a global problem, but he says it doesn't make sense for states to have individual controls. Sturba says much of the mercury pollution in the United States originates in Europe and Asia, and he says there's as much mercury emitted from the world's oceans as power plants. Sturba wants mercury managed and controlled in a sensible manner.
What I don't find helpful is the scare tactics that are sometimes used that ignore the realities of mercury. And I'm just a person who would rather deal with the facts, and on the basis of those facts, I'm willing to commit our dollars to control mercury, even though it's a very small fraction of the amount of mercury and the real issue.
PNM is voluntarily adding state-of-the-art emissions controls at its New Mexico power plant, something Dr. Voorhees calls commendable. In the meantime, environmental groups around the country may challenge the new EPA rules in court. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Authorities arrested 21 women attempting to block logging in the Biscuit Fire Recovery Area in southern Oregon. This is the third time in 1 week that environmentalists unsuccessfully attempted to stop loggers from reaching an old growth reserve in the region, and now the U.S. Forest Service has closed the area to prevent more protests. As Amy Merwin reports from Eugene, Oregon, a plan being used by the U.S. Forest Service to justify cutting old growth forest is facing strong resistance from activists, attorneys, and local citizens near the Biscuit Fire Recovery Area who want to halt the logging until an appeals court rules on the legality of the sale of the timber.
Laurel Sutherland is a spokesperson for the Oxygen Collective. He was on the ground on Monday and Wednesday morning witnessing the protest.
On the sugar pine, there was over 400 rings. The Bush administration issued an unprecedented emergency exemption to the Forest Service to allow them to deny the public the ability to appeal.
Arrest John West! Arrest John West!
John West is the owner of the Silver Creek Timber Company, the only company that is refusing to wait until the court hears the two cases pending before it to begin logging. They were able to remove the blockade. There have been 11 arrests. There are currently chainsaws running inside federally designated Old Growth Reserve. This temporary restraining order hearing is in front of Judge Hogan in Federal District Court in Eugene. If he fails to rule in our favor, then it'll go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco March 22nd, when the court is going to hear the other pending court case. Either of those cases could shut down this logging. So we have a very real situation where we could lose the forest and then win the court case that declares that the logging was illegal.
Wednesday morning at dawn, as log trucks led by a law enforcement vehicle arrived at the Green Bridge entrance to the Fiddle Creek Old Growth Reserve, 35 protesters stopped the logging convoy, and one protester locked his neck to the axle of the lead car, stopping the convoy. Other protesters locked themselves to other vehicles. Spokesperson Laurel Sutherland.
The more we slow down the logging in these forests, the more trees that will be standing if indeed the court shuts this project down.
Tom Lavagnino is the Biscuit Information Officer for the Rogue Siskiyou National Forest.
We're not clear-cutting anything. We're taking dead trees only. We're not even thinning, so we're salvaging. We're following all guidelines for Port Orford cedar and everything else that would limit operations within wet periods. We have approval from all legal angles that go ahead and operate within late successional reserve for fire salvage. So the next step is to hear what the courts say.
NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, requires Oregon and federal agencies to disclose all information used to determine that a particular area requires logging. Lauren Reagan, an attorney for the Forest Protection Groups, says they are challenging U.S. Forest Service records of decision regarding logging in the Biscuit Fire Recovery and Matrix areas. This is Amy Merwin for FSRN in Eugene, Oregon.
An estimated 100,000 anti-personnel landmines are buried throughout rural Colombia as a result of the 41-year-old armed conflict pitting insurgent armies against paramilitary groups and the government. Last year alone, 183 Colombians were killed and 616 wounded after stepping on landmines. However, last month, in an unprecedented gesture, the 5,000-strong Cuban-inspired National Liberation Army, or ELN for its Spanish acronym, responded to the plea of local peasants in mid-northern Colombia, Sur de Bolivar, by clearing the road and removing 71 mines from the region. Nicole Carson reports from the community of Mico Ahumado.
Until last month, children in the isolated villages tucked away here in the San Lucas mountain range could not use the field behind their school to play soccer. The field was strewn with landmines that Colombia's second largest rebel group planted in 2002. The Marxist-oriented National Liberation Army, or ELN, also buried anti-personnel landmines along the 9-mile stretch of road that connects these villages to the outside world. So 2 years ago, community leaders like Alidio Vargas, who lost part of his leg and an eye when he stepped on a landmine near his village 14 years ago, began a local dialogue process so the rebels would remove the mines from the region.
We are obliged to dialogue with the armed actors to defend our rights. I believe the ELN's word that they have demined the road.
While the government of President Álvaro Uribe has been unsuccessful at consummating peace negotiations with the ELN and the country's largest rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, peasant communities in Mico Ahumado and elsewhere are demanding guerrilla groups respect their rights. In the past 4 years, casualties from landmines have sharply escalated, making Colombia number 4 in the world for mine victims, behind Afghanistan, Chechnya, and Cambodia. According to the Colombian Campaign Against Mines, during the past 6 years in the Mico Ahumado region, 7 people have survived mine explosions, 4 people have been killed, and countless livestock have also been killed. A community leader who participated in the dialogues with the ELN, but cannot give his name for security reasons.
It was really difficult to make an armed actor understand that they need to respect our political, economic, and social rights as civilians. We insisted to the guerrilla that their military actions of indiscriminately using mines in the territory would only affect the civilian population.
Along the recently demined road, ELN insurgents demonstrate how they bury and detonate their artisanal anti-personal landmines that sound like this. With his red and black ELN bandana covering his face, Commander Pablo, who leads the Solano Sepulveda Front that operates in the Mico Ahumado region.
It's a process the community has established to protect their lives, their productive activities, and their collective security. But at the same time, it's a gesture for the ELN to finally show desire to help end Colombia's conflict.
Despite the success of this dialogue process, locals in Mico Ahumado still cannot use the recently cleared road until an international verification team reviews the area and deems it safe. Alvaro Jimenez, the director of the Colombian Campaign Against Mines.
We think that a verification is important because it's not about a problem with the ELN. It's about the life and security of the people in Mico Ahumado.
The government of Álvaro Uribe says it won't send a verification team until the ELN commits to a national dialogue process. The UN in Colombia has offered resources for a verification that they say technically is viable. While lacking government support, the people of Mico Ahumado say they have achieved some concrete results in their negotiations with rebels. They say they will continue regional processes like this one because dialogue is what Colombia needs. From Mico Ahumado, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
After 3 days of blockades, Oaxacan State Police have gained access to a town that was the scene of a lynching over the weekend where a mob of residents killed a police officer. In Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores has the story.
On Friday night, a crowd of around 400 townspeople in Magdalena, Tequisistlán, lynched Aurelio Blas Vicente, a state police agent. The 25-year-old policeman was reportedly drunk while on duty when he shot a local taxi driver in the back at close range. The taxi driver was taken to a regional hospital while the state police agent was arrested by municipal authorities and taken to the town's jail. A crowd in the town's plaza turned into a lynch mob when the news arrived of the taxi driver's death. The crowd stormed the local jail, grabbed a cable around the state policeman's neck, threw him from the third floor into the plaza below, where he was beaten, sprayed with gasoline, and set on fire. Although the town's mayor called state police authorities when the crowd began to form, police did not arrive on the scene until 3 hours later, after their colleague was already dead. Homicides committed by police often go unpunished, and Oaxaca State has recently received international attention for alleged abuses by the authorities. Oaxaca human rights attorney Jessica Sanchez Maya explains that this type of impunity perhaps incited the crowd to act violently against the policemen who, hours earlier, had killed one of their townspeople.
I think that this situation is a measure of social discontent. It's a model which shows us that we need to take a break, weigh things out, and determine that the justice system needs to be just that, far from political influence and far from a direct line from the governor's office.
Blas Vicente is the third police agent killed by a lynch mob in Mexico in less than 4 months. In Oaxaca, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.